It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
I didn't get my ticket to Michael Jackson's funeral.
Oh, you ran for it, did you?
No, I actually didn't.
Did you put in all your stuff to get there?
No, but it's like, isn't that bizarre? Winning a lottery ticket to someone's funeral? I just got to say, the concept to me is strange.
Well, what is she going to do with the 1.6 million people that wanted to get in a 17,000-seat arena?
No, I understand that, but it's like...
I don't
know that he had a personal relationship with those people. And he's gone.
You know, in the whole celebrity world, you think you do.
I know, but it's not real.
The attachment of people crying their eyes out. And man, this hole in my life now that he's gone. It's like, what hole in your life do you have, really?
Yeah. I don't know that there's a real hole. It's all perceived. It's kind of bizarre.
It's sad. The whole thing is sad.
I mean, he's an incredibly talented performer, but incredibly bizarre as a person.
Well, a flawed life, and you could say a tormented soul. I mean, the most compassionate thing to say is, whatever happened for this guy, he lived a tormented soul. Whether it's father abuse they talk about, whether it's just other stuff in a life. I find that whole thing very, very sad. That a guy could be that talented and that disturbed, and nobody around him, because you can pay for whatever you want, nobody around you is helping you get whole. They're just giving you whatever you want.
No, it seems like the people that really, really loved him, maybe, I don't even know how you understand, assess that. They didn't like the other people around him because they were controlling him and they were just looking up, you know, the bloodsuckers were just looking out for themselves and just going like, gosh, it is such a dichotomy. You got some people, you know, decrying him the horrible pedophile, and you have other folks saying, oh, he was the most gentle soul that just was full of love, and just go like, okay, somehow those two in the same equation, I don't know.
But it is amazing how you go from this scandalized, even though he's acquitted at trial, he's been 3 years in exile in the Middle East or whatever, and now you die. And everything negative about your life gets a pass. It's just wiped out. And now it's just everybody wants to talk about the treasure, the gift. Oh, man, I just watched a little bit of some of that memorial service this morning, and I'm like, oh, for Pete's sakes, neither one is real. Neither one is a horrible, wacky, idiot, stupid fool, or he's the greatest treasure God's ever given the earth in music and dance. Neither one of those are true. He's just a guy. And he's a fairly talented dancer, I believe. I'm not a Michael Jackson fan, but our heart, the media, the scale of media destroys people as real people. Bottom line.
Yeah, well, you become a personification of something. You become an image to others. As opposed to a reality of this is who you are, warts and all.
Yep.
You become a caricature of what people are wanting to have. And I think all of that goes to the fact that it's in the heart of man to worship. And if that place is not filled, I think, by Jesus Christ himself, it's going to get filled by something else. It really is.
Anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is the problem we're having with some of our right-wing conservative political guys. Yeah?
Oh, yeah? Tell me more, Wayne. Tell me more.
Oh, well, this Mark Sanford thing. Governor of South Carolina.
Oh, the Argentina oops.
Who decides to run to Argentina during Father's Day weekend to be with his soulmate.
You mean he wasn't hiking up in the Adirondacks?
I don't think it was the Adirondack. It was the Appalachian Trail.
Or whatever, yeah.
You got to get it right. This from Chuck Colson, his column for Breakpoint at crosswalk.com. He talked about, you know, he knows many of these guys. He said he went to sadness and depression over Sanford's affair. He said Sanford's admission is simply the latest among the pro-family conservative Christian politicians. Remember Senator David Vitter of Louisiana and his prostitution service? Or just a week ago, Senator John Ensign of Nevada, a good friend I have known for years, he too admitted an affair. And now Mark Sanford, probably the last man in American public life I would have expected to so incredibly disappoint us. These men honored their families and their offices and their Christian faith they profess. Oh, they dishonored their families, their offices, and the Christian faith they profess. But most of all, I'm bewildered. Sanford had it all, a beautiful wife, family, high public office, and he was a viable candidate, perhaps, for president of the United States. Why would he throw all that away?
I don't know. I got a problem with some of that.
Do you?
I do. I'm not going to defend him at all, but I'll guarantee you this. Whatever we thought he had in terms of having it all, it obviously wasn't satisfying enough. So whatever you thought that was, in that man's own soul, it wasn't working. So I don't think he had it. You know, obviously.
I hear you.
I mean, his wife seems to be pretty darn sharp. I at least give her kudos of just going like, dude, that guy's career is his problem. As for me and my house, I'm going to take care of the kids. And I mean,
for all the women whose husbands have been morons in the last 20 years and admitted to affairs,
she brings some sanity.
She's the only wife that I think has responded in a godly manner. Not just, well, stand by my man no matter what he does, or I'm going to deny it, or I'm going to whatever. She honestly is out there with, you're killing me, you're killing the family, but I can't change you. I'm going to live in the space I've got to live in. I admire this woman. I don't even know her. Yeah, absolutely.
What I don't understand is, why is Chuck Colson, and I'm not picking on Chuck, because I mean, I think we do this to a lot of people, but
we do.
Why is it that I'm disappointed to the point of sadness and despair when someone else does something that, gosh, seems strange or kind of I didn't expect? It's like, well, guess what? It happened. Why does that have to emotionally crush me as if somehow now I'm going to extrapolate that something's wrong in the world? It's no different.
Well, to me, if your hope is in an ethic and a creed and political power,
or man's faithfulness to any of those.
Yeah. Then when that gets slapped, which this isn't new.
I know. That's the thing. It's like,
this surprises you. Men of power. People
are corrupted by such.
People who get in charge of whatever.
What a shock!
And get everything they want handed to them on a platter. That they would be unfaithful to their woman?
And an entourage of people to care for them so they don't have to deal with those. That's a shocker?
Yeah, boy. It's just not, is it?
No, it's not. But I also go like, golly, why would you want your life pinned on some other buddy's, you know, I'm hoping they're going to... If you go sideways tomorrow, I will be sad. But guess what? My life will go on. I mean, that's
that, that easily? You're not going to be...
No, I'll cry and I'll write a couple articles.
You're not going to fall down in despair at my own unworthiness?
sure, maybe.
A little bit of that. Give me a little bit.
For a few minutes.
Give me some love. But then if I died next week, you would honor me again. Everybody would honor me. That's just the way it works. If you're... This is the lesson. If you're going to be a lout... Die the next week, you can be a hero again.
I suppose. I just know this. I have learned this much about man. They all have feet of clay, period.
Yep.
There's only one that isn't going to be like that. And it's like, I don't think Jesus is going to, quote, disappoint me, other than if I got a bunch of illusions and expectations of what I think he should be doing for me that he maybe doesn't agree with.
And maybe we celebrate the wrong thing. I was thinking about this when the whole Mark Sanford thing came out. You go, gosh, really, another one? Which you think some of these guys that are paid to be good could at least be good. You know? It's not that tough. A lot of people trying to be good aren't making anything for being good. But I think we always wring our hands over. Can you imagine 50% of marriages end in divorce? And it's such a, you know, it's worse in the Christian world than it is in the secular world right now. The statistics are a little higher if you're a person of faith. Your chance.
There's more to argue about.
There is more to argue about. And you have to add the whole guilt factor, which destroys your relationship. Exactly. Maybe we got it wrong. Maybe in this day of, you can actually go down and divorce your wife or husband without any cause at all. Just, I'm tired of you and I'm done with it. And in this day, to think that 50% of marriages survive, maybe that's the thing to celebrate. Instead of, oh man, only 50% get destroyed. Maybe the fact that men and women who don't have to stay together and fight for a marriage. Maybe we, if we spent more time celebrating that 50% instead of crying over the other 50%, we'd have a healthier view of the world.
Probably, but I also go like, at the end of the day, I'm only in one marriage, and that's mine. And it's not that I don't care about everyone else, but that's all theory. I don't live there. And to be, when you get totally impacted emotionally by the theorizing of what's out there, I just can't go, that's not a real place. That's a bizarre place to get stuck and all messed up. I got to walk things out in my life. I am responsible for that.
Yeah.
And I want to focus on that.
You got to love Chuck Colson's conclusion. He says, so fellow Christians,
okay,
don't be self-righteous, which
hey,
means what?
Hey, thanks, Chuck.
I think he means it by don't gloat over another guy's failure or whatever, but don't be self-righteous. I like that. Don't think righteousness comes from yourself.
It doesn't. It can't. Right. Spot it on there.
But then he
Charles.
Says, let the Sanford tragedy be a cautionary tale. Are you toying with sin? If so, for yourself, your family, and your Lord, stop it. Like, Chuck. Don't you realize?
You had nice finger pointing action on that. That was firm.
Don't you realize that doesn't work? That the point of the gospel is just telling someone to stop it doesn't work. Mark Sanford have every reason in the world to stop it. So did this ensign guy. So did Al Gore. So did all these other people who found their way into self-indulgence.
But I've noticed this one thing. This is another notice I've noticed. When my heart's not captivated by Jesus, I really suck at being righteous.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not like it. There's goodness just oozing in here that is residual that I can just I'm gonna better myself.
There's a good dog and a bad dog.
The reality is all of that. When I'm captured by God, I'm not thinking about, gee, I gotta be loving. Love is happening inside me and spilling out.
Yep.
The trying of something hardly ever accomplishes that thing.
When are we going to get that?
Wow.
That just hard. This is what I think for Chuck blows apart. Just trying to be good by those who even have the most at stake in being good.
Yeah, you have the most to lose.
Yeah, and you can't pull it off because self righteousness doesn't work. It's not just being self righteous. Hey, I'm better than you. It really is when your righteousness stems from your self interest. The day will come when your self interest serving you will destroy you. That's just the way it works. And only, like you said, only that deeper passion who Christ is has any hope of transforming.
Yeah, and it's not, gee, I want to fall more in love with Jesus. It's like, you know, I've tried that for many, many years too. And I'm a very passionate person, zealous guy. But I've only found that it's God's passion for me that has a profound keeping capacity. He captures my fascination. And when he does, my gosh, my life starts to reflect what he's flooding it with, which is great stuff.
It is great stuff. And the reason I copied part of this article off, by the way, it's the Breakpoint from June 26, 2009, if you want to look it up, Chuck Colson, is he said that we seem to have an infinite capacity for self-rationalization.
Yeah, supernatural powers of rationalization, I would suggest.
It's so easy to justify these little compromises in our life. But even more than that, the things we've read lately, and I think we referred to on a podcast previously about how we can, by reliving a memory and changing the facts intentionally at first, becomes believable at the end. This whole ability to self-justify.
Your brain chemistry. You just simply repeat a thought in your head, whether it ever happened or not.
Just long enough.
And scientists have been able to demonstrate there's some kind of like synapse-to-synapse connection that gets, you know, an engram gets planted, and that's how memories get formed. And that may have never, ever happened.
Yeah.
But simply because you have repeated it to yourself enough, finally now you believe as though it did happen. And it's like, that's scary.
It is scary.
I mean, that's profoundly disturbing.
Because I've had people look me in the
eye. I can live there.
I've had people look me in the eye. The co-pastor I was working with, a few years after that whole thing, looked me in the eye and said, this is what was going on. And it wasn't, he gave a whole litany of things. I'm going, do you not remember this? Or this? Or this? And, you know, if he has the proclivity to reshape history, I certainly do too.
Sure.
So I'm going back to, but let's just go to facts. Did fact A happen? And he goes, oh yeah. Oh yeah. And then after that, he didn't know what to do. He kind of went, let's talk later. I have to rethink it. In other words, and this is a process. I'm reading a wonderful book. I think you ought to read this book. I think most people on the planet might want to read this book.
Yeah.
It's called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And the subtitle is this.
I could not author that book.
Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. No, I can name you half a dozen.
Oh,
yesterday.
Yeah. Okay.
Not just yours, mine as well. The subtitle is Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. Now, this is not what you'd call a Christian book. This didn't come from that side of the marketplace. This is a book of studies, and what it is about cognitive dissonance.
Oh, what a glorious statement.
And it is, here it is. He said, I'm going to read you some excerpts from this because I think it'd be fun to talk about some of what he says here. Page 2, as fallible human beings, all of us share the impulse to justify ourselves and avoid taking responsibility for any actions that turn out to be harmful, immoral, or stupid.
You're kind of born with that, right?
We are.
You didn't notice that, little kids.
We are.
Did you do that?
No. Not me. Or, he made me do it.
that's a good one.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Cognitive dissonance, which is the whole deal of, okay, I know a certain thing to be true, but I'm not living like it's true. Here's how he defines it. Cognitive dissonance is a state of tension that occurs whenever a person holds two cognitions, ideas, attitudes, beliefs, or opinions that are psychologically inconsistent, such as smoking is a dumb thing to do because it could kill me, and I smoke 2 packs a day. Dissonance produces mental discomfort, ranging from minor pangs to deep anguish. People don't rest easy until they find a way to reduce it. This is going on scientifically. This goes on in the brain. I can't live with this is killing me, but I'm still doing it. So here's what I got to do. In this example, the most direct way for a smoker to reduce dissonance
this
is by
really
quitting.
Isn't kidding me.
Is by quitting. But if she has tried to quit and failed, now she must reduce dissonance by convincing herself that smoking really isn't so harmful, or that smoking is worth the risk because it helps her relax or prevents her from gaining weight. And after all, obesity is a health risk too, and so on. And most smokers manage to reduce dissonance in many such ingenious and self-deluding ways.
But you know, that also happens in religious circles.
I know. Let's say this. Mostly happens in religious circles.
I don't know about mostly. I don't know that the church is any more hypocritical than others. I just think a lot of times, wherever you have a predominance of shoulds, you're going to have an awful lot of cognitive dissonance going on.
That's why I said mostly.
Okay.
I gave this to a good friend of mine, a brother on journey. He read this book and wrote me. He goes, oh, my. I have so much to repent of. Because it really points a light on how I reshape things going on in my life to justify my behavior. And scripture, proof texting scripture, gives us lots of ways to do exactly that.
Think of just the simple reality. Jesus Christ is a person with whom I can have a relationship. And I should be able to know that. What if I've been a believer all my life and a good adherent to the doctrines and the principles of Christianity, and yet I don't have much, if any, tangible intimacy in terms of a friendship I enjoy, and I'm now at church? I now have cognitive dissonance. I have to behave as though all these great things are going on. How you doing, brother? Oh, beautiful.
Doing great. Loving Jesus. Grace all over the place.
Yeah, and it's like we start with our little Christianisms, and it's like, as opposed to in that moment, having a moment of wonderful heartfelt honesty of just, hey, God, guess what? I got lost again. Where are you? You know, you look at the Beatitudes, you know, blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Well, gosh, with a religious environment, who can acknowledge that? Most of the time, I've got to fake myself into, yep, I'm going to fake it till I feel it.
Yeah.
And it's like, guess what? I don't really think that road works.
Oh, it absolutely doesn't.
That whole pretense. I mean, I love one of the first disciples where Jesus said, you know, in him there's no guile, there's no pretense. It's like, guess what? In simplified English terms, he's not pretending.
Yep.
He's a real person. And I think that's what...
Of course, it was easier for him. He didn't have flaws.
Okay.
He didn't have some... Well, that's what I tell groups when I travel. I think the most... significant indicator of whether or not, and this is going to be a large mega church, it can be a smallest house group, it can just be relational friends together. The biggest sign as to whether that relationship is healthy or not to me is this. Is it confessional or is it pretense? If a relationship is real, people know your flaws as well as your good stuff. They know both. If a relationship isn't real and everybody's pretending to be what they're not, then rumors have tremendous power in non-confessional environments because anybody can tell a lie about you and it holds power because you're already pretending to be what you're not. If people know your flaws already, if because you're as honest about where you hurt and struggle as you are about what joys Jesus is bringing into your life, you're immune from rumors. There's not a lie you can tell about me worse than what I'm already dealing with in my own life and my own struggle. In that community of friendships where people live honestly, rumors have no power. And that's what I think when James is talking about confessing your faults one to another, he's not talking about a formal strategy of I sinned, I must go to Brad and confess my faults. What he's saying is if in my relationship with Brad, my faults aren't as known as my good stuff, then something's wrong with the relationship. It's distorted and I'm pretending.
Yeah, and you're never at peace when that's the case, because you don't really feel known.
You're not known.
And you don't really feel loved. You feel appreciated for all the good stuff, so you got to perform.
And the relationship is fake. So people in those kinds of relationships, I hear this all the time, a lot, I heard recently from a former pastor's wife, loneliest person probably in religious systems is the pastor's wife. Most people relate to her as an image. So she doesn't have any true friends. She doesn't have anybody that really knows her, where she hurts and where she struggles. So all her relationships are, by definition, superficial. And most pastors, too, because they're taught. I was taught, first church I was at, you're not allowed to have any friends here. If people see flaws in you, they'll take you down. Absolutely.
It was taught to you.
Yes. I was told that. My staff orientation training. You're not allowed to have friends here, which I ignored.
Exit stage left.
And two, you can be honest a little bit with some vulnerable, not much, because if the flaws become known,
they'll tear you down.
In fact, I remember one guy saying to me, I'm afraid now that you're working with me, you're going to get to know me so well you won't respect me anymore.
What?
Isn't that weird? Because that really says you're living an illusion. Your authority in this group is derived from an illusion. You're afraid if I see the truth, I'm not going to respect you anymore, as if respect is based on performance, which is sick.
Oh, man. You know, I mean, bringing this full circle back to the whole marriage thing, that is supposed to be one of the most transforming relationships a human being could ever be in.
Absolutely.
That's one that, guess what? Your family kind of is stuck with you. You got born in there. They didn't have a whole lot of choice. Even crappy families know that they got to love you. They got, you know, it's like, whether they do or don't, that's another thing. But there's a sense of blood familiarity where it's like, okay, I got to love you. This person I'm married to chose. Not in all situations, because there's nations where it's been decided, yeah. Okay? But in that whole dynamic, this is someone that has said, I want to be with you. And in the context of that, if I stop performing and I start being my actual real self, that's probably the only place I'm going to start to learn what it is to be loved for who I am, not who I'm pretending or who I'm performing, but loved for who I am. I got to tell you, that does something in the human soul. I can get that from God. I should get that from God. But most of us are not honest with God. We're trying to demonstrate how sincere we are, how intentioned we are.
Well, we're not honest with God because we're not honest with ourselves.
Yeah.
I think that's the whole cognitive dissonance thing. It is, I have created a way that I feel good about me by embellishing all my good stuff and minimizing all my damaging stuff. He says this is from Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. This is by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. And it's worth a read. I'm telling you, it'll challenge me. He said, self-justification not only minimizes the responsibility for our mistakes and bad decisions,
it is also
the reason that everyone can see a hypocrite in action except the hypocrite themselves. it allows us to create a distinction between our moral lapses and someone else's, and to blur the discrepancy between our actions and moral convictions. The prominent evangelist Ted Haggard seemed oblivious to the hypocrisy of publicly fulminating against homosexuality while enjoying his own sexual relationship with a male prostitute. That's, and yet never feel like a prostitute. I mean, I think this book really puts its finger on...
I did not have sex with that woman.
Okay, well, that's not Ted Haggard, but that's obviously another...
It's profound in terms of our incapacity to just take ownership of stuff.
And why I think religious systems, in the end, become just a club of pretenders, and that's not all Sunday morning events, let's make that clear again, that's not what I mean by that, but I mean religious systems that are of performance and obligation just eventually becomes a group of pretenders. And people have got deep, deep flaws that no one knows about, and they've hidden it even from their spouses, and they just justify it. So it's okay, it's not a big deal, I can contain that, and live like this holy person when they're really just being a hypocrite. And I likewise say, you're the one that can't see it. Why? You've reworked the cognitive dissonance so that you've justified whatever you're doing while you can jump down the throat of anybody who's doing other stuff that you don't like. Maybe even the same stuff you're doing, but they got caught. You're smart enough not to get caught.
See, I don't know how in the world anything's ever going to change until you can actually stand stark naked in front of God and go, hey, if I don't get some help from you, this is where I'm stuck. I mean, if I think it's up to me, well, then, you know what? I can't just stand there in all of my little nakedness and go, you know, Lord, I messed up. But if I recognize, guess what? I've searched. It's not within me to be able to do this. If I recognize that I need something in order to walk this life out,
yep,
and I need him.
That's what I took away from this book, to be honest. When I finished this book, I find in my prayer life now, I'm praying that same stuff that David prayed about, shine your light on me. Expose me, search me, know my thoughts. Know my God, I don't want to live any lies. And where I've got cognitive dissonance going on in my own life, I want to live open before you, open before me, and really even going back to stories that you tell that may or may not be as true, it makes me rethink all of those things. That's a healthy, process.
If I end up the central hero, the main character in all my stories,
yeah,
I think I'm missing one central reality. There's nothing I got that I didn't first get from him.
Yeah.
And I recognize...
And he's not done with you yet.
So no.
You're not a hero in every corner of your life.
No. Well, the reality is...
You are to me, Brad, but I just mean
that. I appreciate that. That's very nice. the reality is I now tell stories different in a way that I recognize, you know what? I am only a supporting character in this greater drama of my life.
Wow, that sounds like the beginning of our podcast.
There you go.
I recognize that.
Yeah. When God is front and center in that, I just feel a whole lot more secure. And that's not blaming all the stuff on him and giving him all the... It's just, you know what, God? I really figured out I can't do this apart from you. I can't bear fruit.
Yep.
That whole John 15 stuff, abiding in him. So I want him to be an active part. If I don't know how to be honest with myself, if I don't have the courage to be honest with God and honest with others... then I am living a life of pretension,
yep,
of some kind of hidden performance, trying to find some kind of value that is false. You're never secure in that world.
No.
And I just, you know, I am so thankful when things have frankly shattered and fallen apart and you're kind of left in that disillusioned mess, because it's like, guess what? That's the grateful part. The illusions are gone. Now let's look at what really is. And what do I do with it now? Hey, God.
And if that isn't the message of 1 John 1, of living in the light, walking in the light as he is in the light, which isn't about being perfect. That's how I used to read that passage of Scripture. Walking in the light just means let it shine. Jesus, show me what really is in this circumstance, in this broken friendship, in that dealing. What is the real truth here? And how do we get to that? Because our propensity for self-deception is huge. This is from page 6. I like this. Now, between the conscious...
You're only on page 6.
Oh, we've been all over the book. No, I'm just saying this.
Okay, I was going to say, wow.
Yeah, it's going to be a long podcast. It says this, now between the conscious lie to fool others and the unconscious self-justification to fool ourselves lies a fascinating gray area patrolled by that unreliable self-serving historian, the memory.
The memory.
Memories are often pruned and shaped by an ego-enhancing bias that blurs the edges of past events, softens culpability, and distorts what really happened. When researchers ask husbands and wives what percentage of the housework they do, the wives say, are you kidding? I do almost everything, at least 90%. And the husbands say, I do a lot, actually, about 40%. Although the specific numbers differ from couple to couple, the total always exceeds 100% by a large margin. It's tempting to conclude that one spouse is lying, but it is more likely that each is remembering in a way that enhances his or her own contribution. Yeah. And where this becomes most problematic, and I love this, he's talking about little kids, how they get into gangs, and the initiation rite of doing something violent or stealing something is all part of turning them into this process of cognitive dissonance that I'm going to become an evil person, but I'm going to do it for really right reasons. Here's how that works. He says, when you do anything that harms someone else, you get them into trouble, you verbally abuse them, or you punch them out, a powerful new factor comes into play, the need to justify what you just did. Take a boy who goes along with a group of his fellow seventh graders who are taunting and bullying a weaker kid who did them no harm. The boy likes being part of the gang, but his heart really isn't into the bullying. Later, he feels some dissonance about what he did. How can a decent kid like me, he wonders, have done such a cruel, nice thing to an innocent kid like him? And he says, dissonance goes on from that. Like, I can't live there. So what happens is I start saying, well, the kid's a weak guy anyway. He deserves it. And you start to justify what you do by tearing apart the person you disagree with.
Oh, man.
And I just, boy, when you read that passage, you go, well, haven't we done that with all kinds of people? That's, gossip gets its power because we get to talk about that guy over there. He really deserves what he gets because he's really a bad, dishonest, whatever. And we give up a relationship that inside we're going, well, gosh, he's probably a pretty good brother, maybe lost inside. I don't know. But instead of staying in that space of trying to find the truth and try to find a relational resolve, instead, everybody goes to tearing each other apart. And marriages do it. Business partnerships do it. Relationships get destroyed. When what both people are remembering gets somewhat distorted by the reality in that ego-enhancing thing we call memory. Now, that's just scary to me. If that doesn't lead you to go, okay, I want the truth and only the truth. Jesus, shine your light on me.
See, but therein lies the real challenge. You got a mess just by yourself.
Yeah. I don't need you. I don't need you to screw me up.
I can mess myself up. If Jesus doesn't crawl into the midst of that and help me guard against that proclivity,
yeah.
I'm a mess.
I'm a mess. Here's what he says. By the time this is in the marriage chapter, but it applies way beyond marriage, and it's got the word shame in there, so note how it's used. By the time a couple's style of argument has escalated into shaming and blaming each other, that describes a lot of human relationships, particularly religious ones. We're shaming and blaming. The very purpose of their quarrels has shifted. It is no longer an effort to solve a problem or even to get the other person to modify his or her behavior. It's just to wound, to insult, and to score. That's why shaming leads to fierce, renewed efforts at self-justification, a refusal to compromise, and the most destructive emotion a relationship can invoke, contempt.
Ooh.
Ouch. That hurts. Let's go on to something else. I think that so describes how we have to survive even broken relationships, that we've got to devalue. Instead of no longer, here's what he says, while happy partners are giving each other the benefit of the doubt, unhappy partners are doing just the opposite. If the partner does something nice, it's because of a temporary fluke or situational demands. Yeah, he brought me flowers, but only because all the other guys in his office were doing it. If the partner does something thoughtless or annoying, though, it's because of the partner's personality flaws. And how this cognitive dissonance reinterprets every relationship we have in a way that by saving our bacon and making me look good, I'm destroying people around me.
I mean, I don't know about this, but sad. The most beautiful thing in the garden before the fall is a statement that there they were naked and without shame. And that whole idea of, you know, if you get down to what nakedness is about, is nobody ends up thinking they're naked in the shower. Yes, you are. But the real root of that word, I learned it, is open to the gaze of.
Yeah, studying naked again.
Yeah. open to the gaze.
That's what I'm going to do next week. I got to stop reading this Mistakes Were Made stuff.
Study naked.
I'm going to study naked. I wrote the Naked Church, so yeah, there you go.
You should be able to.
I should.
The reality is what an incredible thing to be able to be open to the gaze of somebody else and not feel any shame. Whatever that was that they lost at the fall, that is so incredibly precious, because look at, you got an entire book that says, there ain't no way you're getting 2 seconds to Friday before this thing kicks in, and you got to start justifying, or you're in that, I can't live their dissonance. That's what was lost at the fall, is that sense of the capacity to be open to the gaze of, and not subject to shame, not subject to the blame, to the having to. It's like, you know what? There was something beautiful there that can be restored and regained, but I think it's got to be in that clothing found in him.
And isn't that the most beautiful part in a relationship, when the people in it become clean?
Or, yeah.
Not in the sense that they're perfect or flawless. I have never I've never been with a brother or sister or a couple that hasn't been honest about a real struggle in their lives, even a failure, even copping to a failure, that doesn't endear you to them. That doesn't have, if you're living in this cognitive dissonance thing and you've got to diss others, I always say transparency is death defying. If you want to be transparent among a cognitive dissonant group of people, you're dead. They're going to kill you. But if you're transparent with other people who are transparent, I know some brothers in Massachusetts, they're lawyers. They've all struggled with pornography. And they got involved working with some young lawyers, young men, that were also struggling with pornography. And these guys have found real freedom in it. So they've started this anti-pornography group. They meet for lunch twice a week. And the only rule is this. Just come here and tell us what you did. This isn't accountability. This is not trying to change you. This is not you promising I won't do it again this week. Just come here and talk about what you're doing. We're talking about what we did and our struggle. And the light of the moment heals the brokenness of how sin gets its prongs in us by living in the dark and living in shame. It multiplies its power over us. And just have another brother and sit down and say, you know what, I clicked on this thing on the website yesterday and this came up and I watched this again. And no one around the room is going, oh, gee, what a disgusting creature you are. No contempt here, because they all know the power of it. They've all been in it.
Sure.
But what they say is, this is not what I'm recommending for anti-pornography groups. I think this is amazing, though. What they say is, if people will just come to the light, it will change. God changes it. If we try to bash them with performance and accountability, it drives it deeper and it makes it even more captivating than without it. That's amazing stuff.
I didn't get messed up on my own, and I'm not going to get healed on my own. And that's not shifting it. It's saying, you know what? It's not within me. I can't do this. I got forces out there that would love to just mess up my life and help me at it.
Yep.
But I got a Jesus that's willing to walk and be the power by which I don't have to do that.
Yeah.
If it's up to me to discipline myself, well, let me know how that works for you, but mine always runs out.
Yeah.
And the only thing I've ever felt really works is really coming to that place of, in the light, honest bankruptcy,
yeah,
of just going like, you know what? I really wanted to do that right. I really, really did. And I really, really didn't.
Right.
And I really, really tried.
Yeah.
When you can be okay there without having to come up with excuses, without, you know, giving all these explanations and just, when you just go like, you know what? I tried and I can't. Those moments in my life are so freeing.
Yeah.
It's like they are the great exhale moments where you just go like, okay, next, somebody, Lord, you got one more person you got to fix here, because I can't do this.
The greatest moments in our marriage have been at those moments where something came out from Sarah or me that hadn't been known in the relationship, particularly in our younger days. I can't think of anything now that would come out that we'd already know about each other. But things that came out that just freed the relationship to grow because it was now known. Hmm. It wasn't in the dark anymore.
Because it could be real.
It wasn't hidden. Yeah, and if a team's really partner, I mean, if your wife or your husband takes your mistake and just beats you over the head with it, then obviously it's not going to be a great day in your marriage. But what Sarah and I have found, we have such a love for each other that when things come out, going, gee, wow, I didn't know that was going on in your head. Yeah, well, because I've never really wanted to talk about that going on in my head. It opens an incredible door of relationship and depth. That's where the relationship grows. I love this as well, and this really hit me hard. This is actually one of the epigraphs at the beginning of a chapter. It's a quote from the novelist Iris Murdoch. I have to confess, I've never heard of Iris Murdoch.
Okay.
But listen to this quote. Love is the extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real.
Say that again.
Love, particularly in the context of the whole cognitive dissonance thing, love is the extremely difficult realization that something other than one's self is real. That it's not just my memory, myself. That when I'm involved in a loving relationship, whether it's my wife or brothers and sisters in the family or people in the world, the loving relationship is this. I'm not trying to justify me at your expense. I realize that love recognizes this very I'm not the only real thing on the planet. My wife is real. You are real. People around me are real. They have different stories, different flaws. If we stay in a relationship of love, there's nothing that even cognitive dissonance will win over. But once the relationship, once you can't live inside love anymore for another person, now you're left to your own memories, self-protections, justification, and ultimately contempt.
Set of nightmares.
Contempt for the person who's hurting you. Where else can you end up? Because now you want to throw them out of your life or you want to do whatever. You end up having contempt for the very thing that's hurting you because that's how this process works. I tell you, I really enjoyed not only this book. It made me think of the scripture where it talks about being lovers of the truth. I think two or three times Paul uses that phrase. Not just being people who want to get by. Not just people who want to live by their own self-needs and make everything in their life conform to that self-need. But lovers of the truth are the people who live in freedom.
Mm.
I want to know the truth about this.
Yeah.
I might be wrong. My memory might be flawed. I want to know.
Just might?
I want to know the truth about stuff. And when you have a passion to know the truth, then I think the light gets to shine. Wonderful things happen. Yeah, is it threatening? Absolutely. If you're honest in the wrong environment, will you get killed? Absolutely. But where you find brothers and sisters where honesty can thrive, where love recognizes not just me in this thing, there's more than one of us here. And how do we find our way to light and life together? That to me is the height of what fellowship is all about.
Mm-mm-mm.
I love it.
Yeah.
So we're on the road. I'm headed off to Colorado Springs on Friday.
I'll see you in Denver.
You're going to join me Denver Sunday. And then from there, I'm headed off to, where am I going? I'm going to Michigan for the following weekend.
Woo-hoo!
So we're going to immediately do the next podcast for you. So I'll have it in the can. Back to back again because life is busy. But looking forward to some of the folks I'm connecting with in the Springs in Denver and then out to Michigan to do something at Calvin College. So that'll be kind of wild hanging out with them. Calvinist types.
Ooh, wow, you're going to get devoured.
I'm getting my tulip on.
Thank you for traveling with us on The God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.